From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Obviously, the most immediately important thing to discuss is the decision by the Second Instance Appeal Court in Brazil to confirm the original deeply flawed conviction of the now presidential candidate, the former president of Brazil, Inácio Lula da Silva. Mm. And they actually increased the sentence from 9 years to 12. But before we start looking at that, and I think it's important to put that what's happening in Brazil and also in Ecuador and also in Argentina in context, because what's happened, all these events are part of much larger processes that are going on in Latin America that continually take us back to the fundamental dynamic that is driving political events in Latin America. What's that dynamic? We talked about it so many times, Don, and it fundamentally, the impoverished majority in Latin America now know that they can have access to a better life, and they can achieve that through electoral politics, and as was demonstrated in the first 10-12 years of the current century. Now, at the same time, against that, the wealthy oligarchic elites in the region are fiercely pushing back, because they've seen that progressive governments do actually make a big difference, and so they to their ability to manipulate events, and as you said, to collaborate in the foreign looting and pillage of their country's economies. Right. So that is the fundamental dynamic. The impoverished majority want a better life, and they also want they've also experienced what it means to have meaningful participation in the political right. decisions that affect them.
Right.
So you've got the right wing pushing back against that. So how are they going to push back against that? And in all these countries, in Colombia, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, well, in all these countries, the right wing traditionally have control over just about all the available institutional resources. So when a government, especially the judiciary, for example, or for example the corporate media stranglehold
right. Right.
on information that arrives to the people in those countries, and then if you look at the cultural inheritance is one dominated by the colonial heritage, which is obviously very much in favor of the right. status quo and the regional elites.
Yeah.
And then if you look at the commercial and economic areas, of course the oligarchies, they've had a couple of centuries to entrench their economic and control and their control of trade. So what's astonishing about the first 10-12 years of this century is the extent to which progressive governments like those of Comandante Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua, and the Kirchners in Argentina, Ignacio Lula da Silva in Brazil, they radically transformed the situation of the huge impoverished majorities in their countries. And so what we're seeing now is the regional right wing reacting against that. How are they reacting against it? Well, one of the ways that they're reacting against it is that they're becoming increasingly dependent on United States diplomatic aggression, but in a world context where United States power and influence and status and control is declining,
it's waning,
against
that's right.
its
yep.
global rivals.
Right.
So that means that the regional elites, on the one hand, they're playing a double game. On the one hand, they're collaborating with aggressive U.S. diplomatic measures, aggressive U.S. military measures, increasing U.S. military presence in the region. But on the other hand, they're also cutting very important deals in terms of their own national economies with the big economies of Asia, in particular China, of course, but not just China, also South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, Taiwan, the countries of the ASEAN countries, and to a lesser extent India. So all those processes are in play, and what we're seeing at the moment is, you see, what is the alternative for the Latin American right if they don't somehow manage to neutralize or destroy the threat of progressive politics that would undermine their position? They've experienced a decade of relative impotence, and they don't like it. So they are now using all the levers of power that they have at their disposal in the current, and in particular the politicization of the judiciary, in order to get what they want. So now having said that, and I think that sets the scene for understanding what's going on in Brazil.
Right. I agree. So, and not only that, just to confirm that this isn't just a personal, singly personal held illusion, I'm looking at a piece. Jose Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, says exactly the same thing, that he doesn't believe in the objectivity of Brazil's justice system generally, and in particular with respect to this case. And of course, you can see exactly what happened last time when you had an attack, successful attack on Dilma Rousseff, the former president, the last elected president of Brazil, where she was removed by a group of people who themselves, it turned out, are actually crooks, and so crooked that even the right-wing media and the judiciary there couldn't protect them from the fact patterns that have become known of crookedness.
Yeah. Yeah, for example, the person that Eduardo da Cunha, the person that drove the illegitimate process that removed Dilma Rousseff from government, and he's the public prosecutor is now asking for that he served 300 years in jail.
300 years.
So well, that complicates analysis of what's going on, because if you look at the kind of center-right media and the neo-colonial media and in the NATO countries, for example, The Guardian or The New York Times or The Washington Post, they will then say, oh, well, this person's been convicted by the justice system. So therefore, they must be guilty, you know. And so it's like, it's a bit like it's straight out of Kafka, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
If you look at this trial of Lula da Silva, it's the first of I think it's five or six cases that have been brought against him, all on the basis of testimony by people collaborating with the authorities in order to get a reduction of their sentence.
All by crooks, in other words.
Yeah, all by crooks. But in Ireland and Britain, there's a word called supergrass. So it's somebody who testifies against their former colleagues and gets either complete immunity or a substantive reduction. In the sentence that they might otherwise receive.
So, and especially you're in a position here where the object is one of deep rooted institutional and interest based hostility and opposition.
Yeah, sure. But the whole motif of corruption, as you've pointed out so in many of our conversations, is one that's wide open to abuse and exploitation by the most powerful interests in the region, in particular, of course, the government of the United States. And it's the government of the United States and its representatives that have worked closely with the regional elites in order to mount these politicized judicial attacks. In particular, through the use of the notorious Odebrecht scandal. So, let's look at this particular case in which Lula da Silva has been sentenced to 12 years for corruption. It involves the allegation that he received a luxury condominium in exchange for giving preference in the assignation of public contracts to a company called OAS, which I think is a construction company that works in the petrochemical sector, among others. Now, at the same time that those judges yesterday were saying that they believed that although there was no concrete proof, they believed that this was likely to be true, because that's now the current legal doctrine almost across the region.
Likely to be true? Really?
Yeah, it could be true. It could.
Wow.
It could, with some degree of probability. They call it indicios. Indications that it may be true.
Right.
And that is now sufficient proof to send somebody like Lula da Silva to jail for 12 years. But if you an actual legal fact that occurred in the couple of weeks prior to the events yesterday was that the same public prosecutor that has made that accusation against, or the same office of the public prosecutor, not an individual, that made that accusation against Lula, accepted in a case against OAS that they were the legal owners of the condominium of which Lulu is supposed to have received as a bribe.
So, listen, a bribe is a payment or some other transfer of beneficial rights to property or some other thing of value, okay? And there is always physical evidence of this. Either there's a bank account that you can trace back, the deposits, or there's a piece of real estate with title documents, or there's a thing, a block of gold or something, and you can say, where did you get that, and trace its, custody back. So what's been produced in terms of evidence, along those lines? Nothing.
Zero, nothing. Lula da Silva visited the condominium once. He'd never stayed there overnight. And it's now been demonstrated that he is not the legal owner, that OAS is the legal owner.
So there's
actually no all the actual proof disproves the allegation by the public prosecutor.
I'm sensitive to this issue. Okay, I'm an expert in this, not in Brazilian law, but in American law, and specifically, particularly New York law. I've got 45 years in the title insurance business. Deeds, title documents, these are things that, I testify as an expert in court on for decades. And so there's no deed with Lula's name or a corporation's name that he owns or some trust or something. Nothing. So, and nobody's produced like a long-term lease that's not recorded or something that shows.
Nothing. Zero.
Well, then it's not his.
Right.
A bribe requires a transfer of ownership and or custody of something, and if he doesn't have possession and he doesn't have the title documents, then it ain't his.
Right. So this brings us back to something that we've commented on in the past. It doesn't matter if there's no evidence.
Right.
The process is what matters.
Right.
Straight out of Kafka, the trial.
Wow.
The process is what matters. Mm. So and that's also true in the case of Jorge Glass, who is the former Ecuadorian vice president, who was sentenced to, I think it's 6 years in jail, which is currently a sentence he's currently serving, also on the basis of testimony from individuals who received the benefit as a result of their corrupt testimony. And zero physical proof, physical evidence in that case against Jorge Glass. Now, the curious thing about this case is that everybody in Brazil, everybody, even the judges in the case, acknowledged that there was no evidence against Lula. But what they've established as the current legal principle in these kinds of cases is that if there is sufficient suspicion indicating that, in their opinion, Lula da Silva might probably have been guilty of even though there's no evidence, then that's good enough.
Wow. I mean, this reminds me of Obama saying, oh, due process? Yeah, we do process. We do a process. When he's talking about droning people.
Right. Oh, no. But this comes straight out of the United States and its NATO allies culture. And as an Irish citizen, I have a very strong memory of the case of the Birmingham Six, who were sentenced to 30 years in jail for a terrorist attack they never did, and the most distinguished jurist in modern British legal history, a character called Lord Denning, said that they must be guilty because if they were not guilty, that would open up the appalling vista, was the phrase that he used. And so his judgment became known as the appalling vista's judgment. The appalling vista that the police and the legal authorities would have told lies.
Wow.
And so, and that's why he although all the evidence was in their favor, that's why he made sure that they stayed in jail until their ultimate exoneration, of course. So that this idea that suspicion is enough is not a Brazilian innovation. It has a long and distinguished history in Western jurisprudence.
Oh, please. Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts, okay? Let's hold her underwater. If she drowns, she wasn't a witch.
All right, yeah, but you don't even have to go back that far.
You know very well the
history of African American, of black activists, of people like Leonard Peltier, of people Lee Stewart.
Oh, for sure.
There's nothing in the Western legal history that gives them any cause for any kind of moral superiority when they look at this kind of process in Brazil. And then, so if you step back from Brazil and look at the broader region, right, we've already mentioned the case against Jorge Glass. But also, if you look at what's going on in in Argentina, the cases that are being brought against former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her former ministerial colleagues are all based on very similar kind of manipulation and abuse of legal principles.
And even of logic, factual logic.
Yeah. Sticking with the focus on the legal mechanisms that are abused. For example, let's take the case of Milagro Sala, and she's a deputy in the regional Pala Sur. It's the regional parliament for the Southern Cone. And she's been in prison for over 2 years now under the legal figure of preventive detention. She's not been sentenced at all. She's being held in preventive detention on an accusation that has never been proved and never been sentenced.
To prevent what? To prevent her from leaving the jurisdiction or something? To prevent what's being prevented?
Well, the argument is that if she were not kept in jail, she might influence the outcome of the trial.
That's what she's supposed to do, I thought. That's what a trial is. You're supposed to challenge the allegations, and that's how you influence them.
No, it's a measure that was originally brought in under the Argentinian military dictatorship. Mm. And so, and the other legal figure that's being abused. And the reason I know anything at all about this is because I read an article by a former attorney general. I think his name is Zaffaroni. Sympathetic to the
defense
policy or the political position of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her colleagues. So the other legal figure that he mentioned in his article is the accusation of illicit association. Right. So if some people were found to have been, I suppose the equivalent in U.S. law would be some version of conspiracy. But here in Argentina, it's specifically being used in the case of the AMIA terrorist attack, to argue that Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her colleagues conspired or got together and argued that they should influence in an illicit way the investigation by Interpol into the AMIA terrorist attack. Right. But Ronald Noble, who was the head of Interpol at the time, has specifically and very deliberately spoken out in favor of Cristina, saying that, much to my surprise, because I always assumed that he was just some kind of mindless functionary who would do whatever his political superiors told him to. But in his favor, Ronald Noble spoke out, and he said that the accusation against Cristina is absurd, because she never tried to influence Interpol's policy on the AMIA case. So despite that, the accusation continues, and as we said just now, it doesn't matter if there's no evidence. It doesn't even matter if there's evidence in specifically disproving the accusation, right, like Ronald Noble's testimony. That doesn't matter.
Right.
What matters is the process. Why is it this emphasis on the process? Because the motivation is not legal, it's political.
That's the same as here in the United States, actually. They have executed people notoriously here, despite evidence of the innocence, because it was submitted too late into some statute, you know, or procedural, calendar item had been passed by. And so the courts themselves would say, as this person was on their way to being executed and ultimately executed, look, you know, yeah, this is exculpatory, but you didn't file it in time, too late.
Yeah. So, and so, for the benefit of our listeners, what is the political motivation? To actually spell it out.
Right.
And the political motivation is to destroy the possibility of a united progressive political movement capable of challenging the control of the regional elites in their respective countries.
Right. That's it.
And so, in Argentina, the big challenge for the various radical and progressive political movements and political parties in Argentina is to unify.
Yep.
Will they be, if because the right wing have learned the lesson of the previous 15 years, or every time they went into elections divided, and they lost to a progressive candidate.
Right.
So now the left in Argentina, places like Argentina, in Brazil, in Ecuador, the left and progressive parties, radical progressive parties, have to relearn that lesson.
Yeah.
They have to unite.
Yep.
And if they don't, the right wing are going to stay in power for a long time.
Yep.
If they do unite, the right wing are finished.
Well,
and it really is that simple.
And what tends to happen is, even if the political geniuses on the left don't get that lesson quick, ultimately the people relearn that lesson and they leave the leadership, quote unquote, behind, because the things are so compelling. You're talking about the fundamentals of survival, you know, housing, education, food security, medical assistance, all of that. And when people are lacking that for a sufficient period of time, particularly people who have been shown that it's only a couple of steps away from them, if only they do this or that thing, sooner or later, it just happens. It's repeatedly happened over the entire history of our species. It must be something that's innate.
Right. And so the right wing, and the fundamental fear of the right wing, is that they know their economic and social policies are going to fail. They know it because they have.
Right? Well, they don't fail. The economic and social policies are going to fail to be sustainable because they provoke a response. The essence of their policy is looting. The essence of their policy is oppression. It's theft. It's suppression. And so sooner or later, the more successful that is, the stronger the reaction that's inevitable that comes from the people to it.
Yeah, And we're not even necessarily talking about a political or a reaction in electoral terms, because right. if you look at the history of Argentina, mm-hmm. and the system just collapsed.
That's right.
Because their right-wing economic policies were so incredibly inept.
Yeah, they lost the legitimacy totally in yeah. front of the people.
So, right. Yeah. So then, and that's what's facing, for example, Brazil, it's what's facing Argentina, it's what's facing Ecuador. The interesting thing in Ecuador is, an interesting question there is, voters in Ecuador are very sophisticated, like voters anywhere else, I suppose, sophisticated depending on how you define sophistication, but that sophistication in terms of understanding their fundamental interests. And so, and when I say that, a majority of the voters. So, that's why Rafael Correa was so successful from 2006 until last year's election, which saw Lenin Moreno take power, and then Lenin Moreno cut a deal with the right wing. But Lenin Moreno's policies are essentially not going to, they're going to be a reversion to the policies that failed Ecuador and sunk the country into crisis between 1998 and 2006, yeah. something like that.
Yeah.
And so if Lenin Moreno continues on that path, we should in our next conversation, we should talk about the consultative referendum that's going to be held in Ecuador, because that's going to be crucial at a regional level, not just at a national level.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes. Want to do a 10-cent sketch of it, so we can pick up some detail next week?
Yeah, sure. If we have that time available, then the consultative referendum in Ecuador is a measure that's been an illegal measure, because it's not been approved as it constitutionally should have been by the Supreme Court. But because the elites want it to happen, it was an idea of the opposition in the election campaign of 2017. It was the opposition that was calling for this referendum, and now Lenin Moreno has given it to them on a plate. And there are various components. There's an economic component, there's an environmental component, but the fundamental political component is an attempt to entrench right-wing political possibilities in power, so that they have a better chance. The right wing will have a better chance as a result, if this consultative referendum is approved, of being able to hold on to political power. Because there are two main things that the referendum is about. One is to prevent Rafael Correa from standing for election again.
Right.
And the other is to give the president power over what until now, as a result of the citizens' revolution that Rafael Correa facilitated, there's a popular council that is able to play a role in political decision making, an independent role. And what Lenin Moreno wants to do is to end that independence and so as to be able to put his people on to nominate the composition of that commission. So and those are the two fundamental political things, and the economic and environmental things are also very important, but they're a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
And the essential thing there is that the referendum talks about tweaks to a few hundred square kilometers of environmental environmentally protected area, but that essentially what they're doing is, because the drilling techniques are so sophisticated now, and they're actually facilitating is a deeper exploitation of an area that until now has been environmentally protected.
Yeah, and this is like a whole basket of goodies. We're going to have to stop here and pick it up next week, but we will pick it up here. So thank you very much, Tony. Appreciate your time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Let's talk about Ecuador next week if we can.
You got it. Yep. Okay, bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.